This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Last month, the Senate Intelligence Committee released their report examining the CIA's use of enhanced interrogation after 9/11. They found that the CIA was using harsher forms of torture that yielded less useful information than we were led to believe. This is California Senator Dianne Feinstein, chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee.
Detainees were subjected to the most aggressive techniques immediately, stripped naked, diapered, physically struck, and put in various painful stress positions for long periods of time.
And that wasn't all. They were also waterboarded, deprived of sleep for days on end, and exposed to noise that was just shy of deafening. Many of us were stunned by this report, leading us to question America's values when we could condone the same brutality that we condemned in others. The answer, of course, is not that simple. Fearing another attack in the aftermath of 9/11, it seems our government did things we're not entirely comfortable with. A lot of what we think, though, about these practices comes down to the words we use. Enhanced interrogation and torture are both incredibly loaded and evoke different reactions. A bigger question, though, might have been raised by President Obama, who said what was unveiled in this report was contrary to who we are. But is it really? Today, we talk about our use of torture and what it says about us. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. You can join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter, at Where We Live. How do you feel about U.S. treatment of detainees after 9/11? Joining us in studio is David Richards. He's an associate professor in the Department of Political Science and at the Human Rights Institute at UConn. His upcoming book is Violence Against Women and the Law. Welcome to Where We Live.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Also joining us is Megan Berthold, an assistant professor at the UConn School of Social Work, who's worked with hundreds of survivors of state-sponsored torture. Her recent book is called Human Rights-Based Approaches to Clinical Social Work. Welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you very much.
First of all, David, I'll ask you, and Megan, I'd like you to chime in. What do you think we should be concerned with in this Senate Intelligence Committee report on torture that we led the show with and that we've all been talking about for the last month?
Well, the most overarching thing to be concerned with is the fact that there was a regime that said that these practices were okay, that this was okay to do these kind of things. And these are things that the world has decided are not okay to do, that in the past the U.S. has decided over the course of many events in history are not okay to do, and that we have to do something about this. I mean, it certainly does, as you said, invoke the question about who we are. You know, John McCain gave a speech when the Senate report came out and said that this is not about them. This is about us. This is about who we are. And we don't do these things. This is the definition of who the United States is. And, you know, maybe we need to kind of recertify ourselves that this is not what we do in that kind of, I guess, moral sense.
This idea that this isn't what we do isn't necessarily held up by the facts of history, though. I mean, there's a sense that Americans in one way or the other have engaged in what we'll call torture or enhanced interrogation tactics in the past. Other countries have as well. We're talking about something that we aspirationally don't want to be, or are we talking about something that we aren't actually?
I think it's something that we're not. And if we go back in history, well, first, enhanced interrogation is a recent euphemism.
Yes.
You know, you go back to the Spanish-American War. There's a cover of Life magazine of a U.S. soldier waterboarding a Filipino on the cover. And it was an article, and there was a story in there about that this had been happening. There had been 160 or so waterboardings that happened. And the military and U.S. public opinion at the time said this is not right, and that person was punished. At the end of World War II, when the U.S. Army drew up its human intelligence manual, it took torture off the table. People who did these kind of things to our soldiers in World War II were executed or sentenced to hard labor, waterboarding in particular. In Vietnam, the Washington Post in 68 famously ran a picture of an American soldier and some South Vietnamese forces waterboarding a North Vietnamese soldier. And the generals had taken waterboarding off the table, and that person was drummed out of the military, and there was a big conversation that ensued at that point that also at that point said, this is not what we do. This is not how we act. This is not who we are.
Megan?
I have worked with many survivors of state-sponsored torture who have been waterboarded, who have been deprived of sleep, and who have been subjected to many other forms of torture as well. I know from working for more than 25 years with these survivors, with more than 1,000 torture survivors, and John McCain knows as a torture survivor that that those methods are torture. I'm also reminded that the U.S., a signatory to the United Nations Convention Against Torture, has not been abiding by all of the provisions. As the UN Committee Against Torture recently concluded in its concluding observations this past November 2014, when it did a periodic review of the U.S. and where it stands in terms of the Convention Against Torture, they have not been adhering to the portion of the convention which says there can be no exceptional circumstances, that torture is not okay, is not permissible, even in situations of terrorism or war.
And I will just say, you mentioned John McCain, of course, someone who was tortured while in captivity. What do you think it means to have someone who is such a high-ranking U.S. official and someone who has been in many ways so unsparing in his belief that we as a society need to root out terrorism, that we need to do many, many things to protect the United States, but at the same point, he can speak very eloquently about what it actually means to be tortured.
I applaud his leadership and his moral compass on this issue, as do the hundreds, actually more than 1,000 survivors I've worked with. I'll never forget when the stories of the U.S. torture in Abu Ghraib and the explicit photographs came out in the U.S. media. I was working as a clinician with torture survivors from many parts of the world, and this horrified them. It horrified me because these were individuals who had fled at great peril after having been tortured by their military and the police in their homelands, seeking asylum in this country, seeking refuge, seeking safety, and always having heard that the U.S. Upheld the rule of law and justice, and being horrified to find that those same authorities, that our government, who they were hoping would protect them, was also engaging in torture. Safety is the most important thing that survivors seek after having been tortured.
David? And Megan brings up a really good point that torture is really an exceptional item legally. There are scores and scores of internationally recognized human rights, and about 7 are taken off the table as never being permissible to violate under any circumstances. And torture is one of those. We call those non-derogable rights. And one of the rationales that came up in the Senate report and was in things like the U memo and the Bybee memo written by actors in the Bush administration was that you can't say that these are exceptions to the exception. There's no such thing as it's so bad we need to torture. Law that the United States is party to doesn't allow us to do that. So we've made a legal commitment to not doing these things, and we're not making an exception to an exception for a very exceptional thing.
We're talking with David Richards and Megan Berthold, and they both study torture. And we're talking about this issue in the wake of the Senate report on CIA torture practices. And we're talking about what these words mean and what it all means to us as a society. If you'd like to join us, 860-275-7266. We'd love your thoughts. One of your colleagues, Kathleen Weldon, is research manager for the Roper Center for Public Opinion Research at the University of Connecticut. Every so often, we partner with the Roper Center to talk about opinions, specifically opinions about the issues that we are talking about on the program. Earlier this week, Kathleen Weldon stopped by our studio to tell us a bit about where the public stands in the torture debate. Let's listen to a clip from that conversation that starts with comments from CIA Director John Brennan into investigations of CIA torture.
When the president came into office in January 2009, he took the position that these techniques were contrary to our values, and he unequivocally banned their use. He has consistently expressed the view that these techniques did significant damage to America's standing in the world and made it harder to pursue our interests with allies and partners, something I have experienced firsthand. But as the president stated this week, the previous administration faced agonizing choices about how to pursue al-Qaeda and prevent additional terrorist attacks against our country, while facing fears of further attacks and carrying out the responsibility to prevent more catastrophic loss of life. There were no easy answers. And whatever your views are on EITs, our nation, and in particular this agency, did a lot of things right during this difficult time to keep this country strong and secure.
In case you don't know what John Brennan's talking about, EITs, stands for Enhanced Interrogation Techniques, something that maybe is torture, maybe isn't. Linguistically, this is one of the questions we're talking about today on Where We Live. As we talk with the Roper Center's Kathleen Weldon, who brings us some of the information about how people feel and think about important issues, what do we know about the Senate report's impacts on how people perceive torture? Because, of course, when a report like this comes out and it uses words like this, it could influence public opinion.
But didn't. In this circumstance, we don't really see an effect of this report. We don't see it changing people's minds. The issue of important information was a key one in the report. The report basically said that it was highly questionable whether any of these techniques had actually led to important information. But it turns out that 53% of the public in a December poll believe that the treatment had produced important information that could not have been obtained from other means. And this is consistent with what we've been seeing. And this is a very important driver of attitudes. 85% of those who said that they believed important information had come from torture said that they thought torture was justified. Only 28% of those who said that they did not think important information had been gained in this way said that they thought that torture was justified.
So that's really the key point here. If people think that torture works to get some information that's going to keep Americans safe, well, then they think, well, torture's okay. But if they don't, then they don't.
That's right.
Again, that's Kathleen Weldon from the Roper Center for Public Opinion Research at the University of Connecticut. David, I'd like to get your thoughts about that. You know, this idea that the Senate Intelligence Committee report on torture didn't really change people's minds about it. They essentially say torture is justified if we get information to keep people safe. About half Americans support the use of torture. I mean, how accurately do you think that this actually reflects how Americans feel about this issue?
Well, I definitely agree that it didn't move the marker in terms of general public support or dissatisfaction with torture. One reason being that the Senate report was a 500-plus page executive summary of an almost 7,000-page document that I would imagine very few of the respondents to the poll read. So what they're reading is maybe, you know, something in Washington Post that says seven top points from torture report. And a lot of that is about oversight, which doesn't really connect in a moral or kind of sense of efficacy of torture. What we saw is from some work that's been done aggregating polls over time is that really it was about 2008, 2009 when things shifted. Before that point, there was a majority of Americans when asked in the abstract about torture that would say, no, this is wrong. But around 2008, 2009, the no, it's wrong and the yes, it's okay is kind of started to converge and they crossed. And after 2008, 2009, we started to see the majority going up towards, okay, well, this is okay. And what we really see in that when you look at the details is not so much independents and Democrats coming over to saying torture is okay, but a concentration of Republicans coming around to supporting it. That is, you know, fewer and fewer Republicans saying, no, it's wrong. So the marker hasn't been moved very much by the report.
I want to get to a few phone callers. If you want to join us at 860-275-7266 as we talk about this report on the CIA. And Vic is calling from Avon. Hello, Vic. You're on Where We Live.
John, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
Hello to your visitors. I'm mostly concerned about the ambiguity of never say never. I personally have been involved. I hate to make reference to this, but the Newtown situation. And I know that what's happened with the families there. And I would question every one of your guests today and say, if you had a child locked in a school and there was a terrorist with a bomb and there's no way you're going to get the information of where that bomb is, the doors were locked, would you not use any type of torture if nothing else worked, if everything else failed? And we've had this argument, my friends and I, for 20 years, and they always said, oh, that's not realistic. Well, today it is realistic, isn't it?
Well, and it's and of course, Vic, you raise a very interesting point, and we're seeing right now in Paris, for instance, instances where people going about their everyday lives are then disrupted by terrorist actions. One thing I guess I'll ask you, Vic, which is the sort of question that is asked in some of these public opinion surveys. If indeed it was shown that the use of torture actually doesn't get actionable information, it doesn't get information that can help do anything to save your loved ones, does that matter to you?
Yes, it would matter, but I don't think that that would be 100% certain. I've had such severe pain in my life that I know I would say anything to stop that pain. And if there's a chance that, and there's no other way you could get that information and you could save hundreds of children from the potential disaster, why not do it if this terrorist has demonstrated that life is meaningless to them?
Well, Vic, thank you very much for your question. And Megan, I'll ask you to respond to that because I think this is something we're going to get another phone call here in a moment. But I think this is something that a lot of listeners might very well say. Look, if this is a last resort to get important information, why wouldn't we use that? We could save thousands of lives or even maybe a few very important lives.
There's two main points that I want to discuss here, and I think David wants to discuss as well. But having worked with so many torture survivors who indeed were in extreme pain, not just physical pain, but also psychological, spiritual pain, they often did feel that they just wanted the torture to stop. However, by and large, they didn't believe it ever would. They didn't believe that they would walk out alive. And the overwhelming evidence from clinicians, from researchers, but also from some top retired military personnel, U.S. military personnel, is that torture does not yield accurate information. I can tell you that I've worked with many individuals who have given false information just to buy themselves some time in a longstanding torture. The other point I wanted to cover before turning it over to David is that when we torture as a country, many of us believe that it puts our U.S. citizens, that it puts our military and other personnel in great danger of being, of that much more so, of being tortured.
And that is certainly, I think, an argument that has been used many times over the years, and it makes an awful lot of sense. One thing that I think maybe Vic, our caller, maybe others might say is we seem to also be entering a world, if even just looking at the news of this week and the actions of Boko Haram, one might rightly say that it does not matter what we engage in because there is always something incredibly depraved that someone might do to U.S. citizens regardless. That there's almost no limit now to the type of depravity that we see in people around the world, frankly, when they are acting in a terrorist fashion.
I appreciate your use of the word depravity. And I would ask us to consider, do we want to perpetrate depravity? Is that the kind of nation that we want to be and the citizens that we want to be? What happened at Newtown and in many other parts of the world is completely horrifying. These are grave violations of humanity and of human rights.
And I only bring it up just to say that I think that argument that U.S. citizens might be in greater danger, I think, frankly, that ship has sailed in the globe 2015 because people are willing to do all sorts of things no matter what others have done to them. David, quickly, if you would, because I want to get to another call.
Yeah, the framework that the caller brings up is the classic ticking time bomb scenario that people use to argue on behalf of torture.
And it's in the movies a lot, I noticed.
It is, and it actually comes from a novel. It doesn't come from real-world experience. It comes from a 1962 French novel about the experience in Algeria where a woman insurgent is beaten into submission to tell where all these bombs are hidden around Algiers. It doesn't come from experience. And actually, the people that even make the argument that, well, torture yields significant information, make the point that this information usually comes between 7 days and 30 days after the torture, which doesn't fit that scenario either. It's just things don't happen fast, even if you believe in it.
What I want to do is take a break, and when we come back, we've got a few phone callers who want to join us. We're talking about torture. today in the program with two people who study it very, very closely, David Richards and Megan Berthold. They're both from the University of Connecticut. We're talking about public opinions about torture, what it means to us as a people, about our society. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. You can also comment on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Since 1984, 155 states have ratified the UN Convention Against Torture, considered one of the most important human rights documents in ridding the world of torture. Yet today, 30 years after its creation, more than half the states party to the convention are still practicing torture. We're talking about torture in our society today, especially in the wake of this Senate report that came out last month. If you'd like to join this conversation, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. We're talking today with David Richards, who's an associate professor in the Department of Political Science and Human Rights Institute at UConn. Megan Berthold is assistant professor at the UConn School of Social Work, who's worked with hundreds of survivors of state-sponsored torture. Let's go to the phones here. Nate is calling from Glastonbury. Hello, Nate. You're on Where We Live. Hi, Nate. Okay, we're going to move on to Carrington. Carrington is calling from New Haven. Go ahead, Carrington.
Hello. Let's see. One point I'd like to make is that torture itself is a tool of totalitarianism. And that's where it comes from. That's where we know it best. And we know how it works. A good distillation of how it works is provided to us in 1984, Orwell's novel. I think the key point that we have to remember is that that kind of tool, using that tool in our society, is inherently corrupting and in many ways an existential threat to our society, to our Republican form of governance, and to our freedom. And I'm perfectly willing to take the risk of other smaller threats from terrorism in order to avoid this larger threat of totalitarian creep. Thank you very much. I'll take the next.
And Carrington, thank you very much for that. David, you have a comment?
Well, I would agree that torture is a corrosive practice internally. I would think that in terms of those who are involved with it, it's a very powerful drug. And I think it's been described that way by people who have kind of come out the other side of being violence workers. And, you know, I'm thinking of one quote that I had read from a Marine commander in Iraq talking about the issue of torture with his troops. And he said that, you know, there can be no flexibility in the line against torture at the top of the command, because that little bit of flexibility drops like a rock through the ranks and becomes just completely open season on detainees and encountered persons at the bottom. And that speaks towards the fact that it's a powerful, corrosive activity.
What else can you tell us about what we know about people who are able to, willing to engage in torture? I mean, it is something that if it comes from the top in a military command or the CIA, this is one thing. But there's always a question, are any of us capable of doing something like this?
Yeah, I believe most of us probably are. And there's a lot of social psychology research, and Megan could probably talk to this a lot more sophisticated than I can, that shows that environment has a lot to do with somebody's ability to engage in these practices. The Greek military junta, the Nazis, the CIA have all, you know, done a lot of work in how do we turn normally socialized individuals. It could be, you know, through the process of groupthink, through exposure to violence. You know, persons who have witnessed or experienced violence are more prone to kind of being able to do these things. There's a whole host of factors that, yes, most of us probably in the circumstances of someone else could probably do this.
I agree very much with David's comments and the comments of the last caller as well. I have had the opportunity over the years to work with individuals who have perpetrated torture and other gross human rights violations. David mentioned the case of in Greece. There's a very interesting movie called My Brother's Keeper, which shows the process of Greek soldiers learning to become torturers. And what we know from that movie, from research, from clinicians who have worked with perpetrators, is that often, including within military and police cadre, that they are educated by torturing them, in the process of training them to inflict these practices on others. And David mentioned the environment and everything. There's also a lot from my personal experience, brainwashing that goes on. And getting the group, those perpetrators, to see the people that they end up torturing not as humans, but also as a severe threat to everything that they know and love and hold dear in their society.
And to be clear about this, this severe threat that they're being told these other people are, it's not always in the instance of the ticking time bomb. This isn't the existential 9/11 threat that we're talking about here, or as somebody just tweeted at us, you know, the Jack Bauer from 24 threat. He's the good guy who's torturing the bad guy. But this is actually seeing the other as a type of enemy that you both are looking for information from, but you're really punishing, that you're controlling.
Very much so. I'd like to mention that much of the torture that goes on in this world is very much outside of the ticking time bomb scenario. Many of the survivors that I and others have worked with were tortured because of their religious beliefs. Were tortured because they were fighting for the rights of girls or women. And these values, it's really a cultural threat, a spiritual, a religious threat, or in some cases, a political threat, where individuals are fighting for democracy and freedom and rights in their societies. As the previous caller mentioned, often these things take place in totalitarian societies.
And I think you're right, John, that the outgroup, how you regard the outgroup, has a lot to do with this. To get people to commit violence against other human beings, it's easiest if you can dehumanize the other person, right? And especially if you're looking at torture as a human right. Human rights are something that humans have. So if you dehumanize a group or a person, it becomes easier to do terrible things to that person. And it's as easy as scapegoating, right? And a lot of observers have said that, you know, the U.S. torture has a racist element to it, that, you know, you look after the Oklahoma City bombing and you've got these white Christian former military perpetrators, and they weren't waterboarded or, you know, ducked in frozen water or anything like that. But now, because we have brown Muslim people, that this is happening to that. Kind of like the difference between the Japanese citizens and the German citizens of the United States, the way that they're treated during World War II. So that's out there as well.
Is it inherently harder to torture people who look like us? I mean, is that just basically at the core of it, or is what you're saying have something to do with the state sanctioning of something that you're saying is racist? I mean, is there something that we can say about us as a people that says he looks too much like me? I can't dehumanize him.
Well, I can't speak from the perspective of a violence worker, and I'm glad to say that. But I can say that I think that it's easier to sell torture if you can sell it, that it's being done to a group that's not the people that you're trying to sell to.
I want to get some more phone calls. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266, as we talk about whether torture could ever be justified. We're talking with experts in this field here from UConn. Paul's in Simsbury. Hi, Paul.
Hey, good morning.
Hi.
I wanted to call since the beginning of the program today because I really kind of find it offensive to even engage in a term such as enhanced interrogation techniques when we're talking about practices that have historically and I think only objectively can be viewed as torture. And the fact that some clever attorneys at the Department of Justice can drum up means to justify techniques that have always been considered torture and call it something else and come up with a name for it, when we engage as to whether that's in torture, then they've kind of won the battle because they're taking an issue that has always been beyond question and putting it in doubt merely by changing the name of it. as opposed to changing the practices.
And Paul, thank you very much. It leads us into another bit of the conversation we wanted to have. Kathleen Weldon had joined us earlier in the week. She's research manager for the Roper Center for Public Opinion Research at the University of Connecticut. And we talked a bit about some of the words and the way in which we use these words, things like enhanced interrogation or torture. Let's listen. So what does all this tell us about what people think actually constitutes torture? I mean, we hear Brennan talk about EITs, enhanced interrogation techniques. People, you know, have varying opinions on what different types of techniques might be torture and which might just be interrogation. Do we learn anything from these polls about how people feel on that question?
We learned that there's a disconnect between specific techniques and their attitudes about the overall program. So 49% in that December poll said that the CIA's treatment of suspected terrorists amounted to torture. 38% said no, it didn't. Now let's look at the specific items. 69% in 2014 said waterboarding was torture. 73% said threatening to sexually abuse a prisoner's mother counted as torture. 70% said forcing a prisoner to stay awake for up to 180 hours was torture. 57% said forcing a prisoner to take an ice water bath was torture. So the individual items that we know were part of this program, people tend to say, yes, those things are torture, but they don't necessarily say that the overall effect was torture.
And in questions like the ones that are being asked, I'm sure that people aren't describing exactly what waterboarding is. Waterboarding is just a term that people use, or are people actually saying, this is what waterboarding is like. Do you think this is torture?
They actually describe a procedure known as waterboarding in which interrogators produce the sensation of drowning in a restrained prisoner by either dunking him in water or pouring water over his face.
Wow. See, and that's so interesting because I think the term waterboarding has become so loaded. It's sort of a stand-in for a lot of other things that we might say in our own lives is really, really bad. It's like waterboarding. And until you describe what it is, people don't really get it. Then you say something like that and people go, oh, well, that sounds like torture.
They do.
Talk a little bit more about some of the wording of some of these questions, because this is really, really important. Whether we're talking about harsh interrogation techniques, whether we're talking about valuable information gained, this is important when you ask people questions about this stuff.
It is important. There is not as much variation as you might expect from using the word torture and using terms like harsh interrogation techniques. I think there's been enough discussion in the media that people understand what that is stand in for. The discussion about bringing in important information, reminding them of that in the question, I think can have an effect. We have plenty of experience, pollsters do, in dealing with new and emerging issues. But very rarely does a new emerging issue of debate have such deep emotional charge as this one does.
And that's Kathleen Weldon, research manager for the Roper Center for Public Opinion Research at the University of Connecticut. She joins us periodically to talk about opinions, and the opinions today are about the issue at hand. We're talking about torture in our society. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Of course, as she also told us, almost all of the public opinion studies around torture have been done since 9/11. There aren't a whole lot of public questions about it beforehand. David Richards, I'm just wondering if you have a quick response to some of what you heard Kathleen say.
I do. I would disagree that that's an adequate description of waterboarding. It's not doesn't produce a sensation of drowning. It's controlled drowning. It's not simulated drowning. When you fill somebody's lungs with water, they're drowning. And if you actually described the death spiral into terminal hypoxia, where the body doesn't have enough oxygen to function anymore, and that horror, people would have a different opinion. I use another example from my own research. We found a list of things doing some public opinion polling that people are more okay with than others. One of the things that people are okay with is hooding. You know, and they're asked about, well, what about hooding the suspect for long periods of time? And most people think of hooding as putting maybe a pillow sack over their head. But when you think about how it's actually done, what if you made that sack out of burlap, or you filled it with fiberglass or urine or blood or feces, like is often done? And it's usually done in conjunction with other things. Most people are familiar with the story of how Houdini died. He was punched before he could kind of get himself ready, and it caused internal injury. Well, when you're hooded, you can't see blows coming, so you can't steel yourself for kicks and punches that are coming your way, and so it creates greater injury. It creates significant psychological trauma. It also allows people to perpetrate things to you that they wouldn't do otherwise because they can't see your face or your eyes, and you can identify them. So these things that sound maybe not so bad when you get into the details of how they're actually practiced are a little more horrifying than most people, I think, would feel that they are.
I just want to add one thing to David's wonderful description of hooding, and that is that if done for a prolonged period of time, hooding as well as sleep deprivation as well as solitary confinement can make a person psychotic in very quick order. Even if they have never, and there's no family history of psychosis, and they themselves have never had any psychotic break previously.
Adam from West Hartford is calling. And Adam, you've got a really good question here. Thanks so much for calling.
Good morning, John. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, we've talked about a lot of the techniques that would be classified as torture, waterboarding and hooding and sleep deprivation. But one thing that I don't know that we've talked about, and I'd like your guests to touch on, is what are some techniques that would not be considered torture that have been shown to show results?
It's a very good, simple question, and I appreciate it very much. And David, Megan, maybe you have some thoughts on this. I mean, before we get up to the level of these things that we're describing as torture, are there ways to interrogate someone who you need information from that don't step over that line but indeed are shown to be effective?
Sure. When you talk to interrogators that have worked in the CIA or FBI or other agencies, they say that the quickest and most effective way to get intelligence from someone is to build rapport with that person. And there have been examples of FBI and interrogators in the post 9/11 framework sitting in a hospital room for a week and helping a suspect, you know, use the restroom to build rapport with this person to get information with them. And to a person, I think that's the story that I've heard, that the most effective way to get information is to build rapport in the quickest way.
I want to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk more with our guests from the University of Connecticut. We're also going to be bringing in a physician to talk a little bit more about the medical community's involvement in torture. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. We don't often associate doctors with torture, but the recently released Senate Intelligence Report on Torture says doctors monitored detainees receiving torture and psychologists helped to create the military's so-called enhanced interrogation program after 9/11. That's part of our conversation today. I want to welcome in Leonard Rubenstein, who's a senior scholar at the Bloomberg School of Public Health, core faculty at the Berman Institute of Bioethics, both at Johns Hopkins University, and principal author of a task force report called Ethics Abandoned, Medical Professionalism and Detainee Abuse in the War on Terror. Leonard, welcome to our program. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's good to be with you.
What role did health professionals have in the torture of prisoners held in U.S. custody after 9/11?
They had many roles. I think, put most simply, it's that they were the facilitators and enablers of torture. As this discussion showed, torture is an extremely severe infliction of pain and suffering. And in order to justify it, they brought in doctors and psychologists to say, this is okay. They also needed doctors to make sure people didn't die. In fact, the memos from the CIA said, doctor had to be on site for waterboarding with resuscitation equipment. And the CIA report, the Senate report, shows that there were cases where people almost died and medical intervention was required. But the most insidious aspect was the justification. Before, your guests talked about how torture is corrupting and corrosive. And what happened was, under the guise of protection of detainees, They had doctors and other medical folks justify these methods as not inflicting severe pain and suffering, which, of course, is untrue. So they were drawn in because of the very harshness and severity of the harm that was being inflicted.
There's obviously a very clear ethical oath that doctors take. It would seem as though the practices that you're describing cut against all of those ethical oaths.
They did indeed. And what we have to look at is not just how the individuals violated their oath, but how the CIA itself at the institutional level induced these kinds of violations and basically told their medical staff that they were adhering to their oaths, which hard to believe, but that's what they actually said. So they drew people in under the guise of protection, but were really making them cogs in the machinery of torture. And in some cases, doctors or other medical staff intervened to make the torture worse.
If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. We're talking today about torture on the program. Bill in Naugatuck. Hi, Bill. Go ahead. Hi, Bill. Are you there? Let's move along from Bill, and let's see if we can go to Ed in Fairfield. Hi there, Ed.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. What's up?
My comment actually reiterates your previous speaker. I served in the Marine Corps across 25 years. The responsibility for torture lies in the civilian authorities. Our nation has always been the nation that has had the military serve the will of the people as directed by their elected representatives. And so while you quoted a Marine officer earlier saying that toleration of torture at any level would lead to that proceeding down into the ranks, as a Marine officer, I cannot overemphasize that. Marines are completely familiar with the laws of land warfare. There's annual training. What happens in the field is not always in tune with that, but there's a difference between an action that takes place in the field under duress and a calculated torturing of a specific individual. The civilians who directed this last disaster of a war, and they are the civilians, hold full responsibility. The military are not torture workers. It sounds so much like sex workers. I'd never heard that expression before. But responsibility is in the hands of the elected officials and the population at large, not the military.
Ed, thank you very much for your phone call. And Leonard Rubenstein, I'll put that to you. Who do we hold accountable, and how do we hold those accountable for this?
Well, everyone should be held accountable. Those who established the rules that allowed torture, those who put in the procedures that set forth how torture was going to be administered, and those who were on site doing the torture. And it's very unfortunate that we've had no accountability. We've had no accountability of any people at any level. Now, the torture convention, which you've talked about before in this hour, says there must be accountability. In fact, there must be criminal prosecutions and investigations. Those haven't happened. There should be accountability for the doctors. Those individuals should have their licenses taken away, and if they were directly involved in torture, they too should be held accountable criminally. It's very unfortunate. Other countries have eventually held their both political leaders and torturers accountable. For example, Pinochet was eventually held accountable for torture in Chile, and it happened all over the world, but we have a long way to go in accountability.
I'm wondering, David, if you might want to weigh in on this question that our caller raised.
Yeah, I agree with the caller completely. I think that this is at the top a failure of civilian leadership. Creative lawyership does not create torture as a device that's legal or ethical, justified or in terms of its efficacy. And I agree that there should be accountability. I think it's a failure of the Obama administration to just treat this the way that Ford treated Watergate and say, well, we're going to just kind of move forward and not look back behind us, because this has been something that's been with us for a very long time. And it shows the rest of the world that we're pretty insincere about principles that we espouse internationally as being core principles of our society.
And Megan, I'd love your thoughts on this too. And I guess as we talk about who should be held responsible and we think about how we all might be held responsible, a lot of the conversation that we've had today suggests that many of us could, in our own way, be responsible for torture by just silently condoning what our government or some other government has done. I'd love your thoughts on this.
Silence is certainly being a bystander to torture, even if one is not in the room, but knowing that it goes on, or even being an architect of the torture methods, those people are responsible. I have worked with torture survivors who were tortured by physicians, by dentists, and also were tortured by people who the U.S. military and U.S. psychologists trained and were supervising. Leonard Rubenstein mentioned that often physicians were brought in to ensure that the people that were being tortured lived. And I just wanted to extend that thought a bit. While many people who were tortured were assassinated, part of the plan, part of the strategy, was to return many survivors of torture back into the society to serve as a lesson to others that were deemed to be dangerous to the state, to the authorities, to return them back a different and in some ways broken person, to say, this could happen to you too. If you go against us. And I just want to say one of the most common consequences of state-sponsored torture, which is, I would argue, unique to any kind of human-perpetrated trauma, is that it instills a profound sense of distrust in others. And it's difficult then. I've worked with survivors who had a physician come in to their cell, and they thought, oh, great, now I'm going to get some help. But indeed, no, they were part of the torture. And it makes it very hard then, as a person is seeking to recover from that experience, if they are in a safer environment, such as maybe they fled to the U.S., and are seeking psychological and medical care, to initially be able to trust those healthcare providers and the other authorities here. That is a huge part of the healing process that I and other clinicians, medical and otherwise, engage in with survivors.
And David?
For the listeners that are interested in this doctor-torture-victim relationship, there's a terrific piece of art that they could connect with, and it's called Death and the Maiden. It's a play by Ariel Dorfman. It was turned into a movie, and it's a three-person play between a torture victim and the doctor who tortured her accidentally shows up on her doorstep, and her husband is a lawyer for the new Human Rights Commission in the country. And the dialogue between these three individuals addresses everything that Leonard and Megan have just talked about. It's very interesting. It's something that if they're interested in that, they'll want to check this out.
And it is very powerful. Leonard, I'll let you go have the last word on this.
Just on the caller's point about the higher-ups, just to illustrate how this worked, the CIA had an Office of Medical Services. These are the people in Langley, not in the black sites. And they issued a memo saying it's okay to waterboard people 15 times a week, that it's medically acceptable. It's okay to subject people to cold up to the point of hypothermia. So they're telling their own medical staff, they're telling the CIA, they're telling the Justice Department that it's okay. So we have to see how the authorities at the highest level of the CIA were involved in this element of corruption of medical practice.
Leonard Rubenstein is a senior scholar at the Bloomberg School of Public Health and core faculty at the Berman Institute of Bioethics, both at Johns Hopkins University. Thank you so much for joining us, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you also to David Richards from the University of Connecticut and Megan Berthold, also from the University of Connecticut, for leading us through this difficult but important conversation. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Our program is produced by Betsy Kaplan, Tucker Ives, Lydia Brown, Kyone Wolf. The executive producer is Katie Tolarski. Our digital editor is Heather Brandon. I'm John Dankowski. This is Where We Live.